So I'm going to talk to you this morning about one of Sangharakshita's aphorisms, which you'll find in the book A Stream of Stars. I tried to do a little bit of research to find out where this had come from, whether it was a seminar or a book, but asked several people, and it turned out that in all likelihood it just came from Bhante's notebook that... out of his own reflections, he just bang, wrote down the aphorism, just nothing else kind of around it. But you could, in a way, say that this particular aphorism, just everything else that he's spoken about is around it. I think it sums up some real core aspects of Sangharakshita's presentation of the Dharma. And it's very practical, which the Dharma should be. So this is it. This is the aphorism. I'll be sharing my kind of meandering reflections with you this morning. Four basic propositions. One, man can change. Two, he can change himself. Three, he can help others to change. Four, together they can change the world. Man can change, he can change himself, he can help others to change. Together, they can change the world. And I think this aphorism represents a life that embodies the archetype of the king. A life that's lived knowing change, directing that change in terms of transformation, taking responsibility for ourselves as agents of karma. A life that's lived helping other people to do the same. And a life that's lived coming together with others to transform the world around us so that, the world can support the highest values. Man can change. So a good king is a wise king. He sees the truth of change. So this first proposition is... you can change. We can change. It's in our nature. It's who we are. It's hardwired into everything, this truth of change. Now, Buddhasthira mentioned that I've changed. It's quite scary in a way to think about what it used to be like. But come here, Philip. There were times when I didn't believe that I could change. That's right. There were times when I this flawed person that I experienced myself as, I thought that that was who I was. I thought that that was who I was meant to be, and I thought that that was who I was always going to be. It was like this this poisonous mantra pacing up and down the prison cell of the mind, just, you know, rolling around. This is who I am, this is who I'm meant to be, this is who I'll always be, over and over and over. But I did, despite this, you know, I did want to change. I just couldn't see how to change, and because I couldn't see how to change, I didn't think I could change. So I was kind of stuck in all of this. But I definitely had a sense that was more. Yeah, it's like there was something throughout this was tugging at my sleeve. Just saying, no, there is more. But I'm just like, I'm so flawed. I'm so inherently more flawed than anyone else, and particularly special in just how flawed I am, that how could I possibly change? And the thing was, I didn't have a king. That, I think that was what was going on. The king was a skill. And there was a dream I had, which for me really communicates this. So it's in a subterranean place. And there are two kings. One king, his banner, his animal, is the eagle. He's a king of light, a king of good. The other king is his emblem, his banner, is a crow. He's a king of darkness. And they fight. And the crow king kills the eagle king. And as he does so, the eagle king's warriors give chase to the crow king, who disappears through this trapdoor further into the underworld. And so it's just this empty chamber, devoid of king devoid of warriors. And yes, a land without a king is a barren land, is a sick land. But for me, when I encountered the Dharma, when I encountered the Buddha, it's like, you know, I didn't articulate it like this, but this is the king. The king has returned. Here is a king whose banner I can follow, and here is a path along which I can follow that banner. Now, this path, as I soon discovered, is based on certain principles, and a key principle here is the truth of change. And actually, there might be parts of us, well, indeed, there are parts of us who believe we can't change. Yeah, they're just unconsciously, there are parts of us that think we're kind of somehow this stuck, fixed, permanent entity, and that perhaps the Dharma will produce some kind of cosmetic change. But we do believe we can change up to a point, because we wouldn't be here otherwise. We wouldn't have gone to a Buddhist centre, we wouldn't have come on retreat. There'd be absolutely no point in doing any of those things if we didn't, to some extent, think we could change. You wouldn't, yeah, there's just no point in it. So this this truth of change that underpins this path upon which I saw I could, yeah, just follow the Buddha's banner. Buddhism sees that everything changes. Buddhist Seer was telling me that his daughter Florence has a particular game going on for years where she'll try and come up with something that is actually permanent, that doesn't change. How many years has it been going for?
About seven.
Seven. She's still not come up with something yet. But but everything changes. Thoughts, emotions, subatomic particles, oceans, mountains, galaxies. Just from the smallest to the vastest, everything changes. And whether you measure it in tiny little nanoseconds to vast incalculable aeons, some things can seem permanent because they just exist on a different timescale, but it's all change. It's all change. It's all impermanent. Anicca. All conditioned phenomena is continually arising and passing away. And if you look a bit more deeply into this truth of change that underpins the fact that man can change, that we're not separate from, in this flow of arising and passing away, you find that there aren't actually any discrete, separately existing things. It's not like there's this conveyor belt where kind of, you know, this turns into this, turns into this, turns into this. Just things flow into one another, yeah? So one of the ways Sangharakshita talks about this in the Three Jewels, in the Dharma section, he gives the example of a leaf. So a bud comes into being on a tree. As a bud is going out of existence, a leaf is coming into existence. As a green leaf is going out of existence, a red leaf is coming into existence. But there's no particular point at which, you know, they definitely, it's now it's one thing, now it's another thing. It's like, where does the river stop and the sea begin? It's not like there's not a line there. There's just these labels we use to make sense of the flow of change, to kind of pinpoint these vague approximations where we can kind of make sense of our sense impressions, our sense phenomena, to kind of just operate in the world. But the problem is these kind of labels we use to kind of, you know, say Buddha Seer, lectern, Buddha, sun, tree, chair. They're kind of, although they're useful for us to make sense of our sense impressions, we mistake them for separate existing things that somehow exist separately from change, and change is the thing that happens to these things. And we extrapolate from that and we kind of we fix things and we fix ourselves and we limit ourselves. We might think we can change to a certain extent, but there's somehow there's this core of us which will always be a certain way. But when you look deeply enough into impermanence, into anicca, you come to the truth of insubstantiality, the truth of anatta. That is what change is predicated upon, is that things are insubstantial. There aren't these discrete things. And the way Banti puts this, to kind of summarise it, and to paraphrase him, it's not that things change, things are change. And the extent to which we see this, the extent to which we're integrated and emotionally positive enough to kind of really hold the implications of this, is the extent to which we can change. The extent to which we believe we can change is the extent that we can change. Now, of course, we don't actually really, on a certain level, an unconscious level, really want to face up to the truth of change. Yeah? Because actually, this brings with it a certain existential challenge, a certain existential insecurity. We want permanence. We want security. Pranikata was talking about going for refuge. We're going for refuge the whole time. We're looking for permanence. We're looking for solidity. We're looking for security. We don't want to look at the evidence that's kind of going, no, actually, everything is constantly arising and passing away. You've got it now, but it will pass. We don't really want to look at that if it's not on our terms. We can get a bit vague about the implications for our lives. We're probably going to live forever, if not till 170. And you just like getting old. Well, that's what happens to old people. That's what old people do. Somehow, you know, just where did all these old people come from? That's just always been like that. And this is ignorance, this is delusion. And the interesting point here is that ignorance isn't something we have, it's something we do. Yeah, it's a choice. It's a choice not to look at the inconvenient truths of life and just focus on the things which support our the views we currently hold, our sense of self, our sense of identity, security, all the rest of it. But when we do this, we are abdicating the throne of responsibility. So, in terms of taking on board this first proposition, man can change, really what we're doing is we're starting to challenge the unconscious tendencies we have to really kind of like look at reality, look at the way things are. And so man can change because he's impermanent as any other conditioned phenomena. He's as insubstantial as any other conditioned phenomena. We don't have an eternal soul. We don't have some kind of unchanging essence that makes us uniquely who we are. But as threatening as this is, it's also a relief. This is the other side of the coin. It's actually good news. Good news, we can change. You are not at the peak of your life. Yeah, it's not like you've kind of reached this point and it's just like flatline until this thing you'd rather not look at called death happens. Yeah, it's actually, there's more. There's more. You are not the sum total of it all. We can grow and develop. But the truth of change comes with a warning as well. Yeah? It's not all rosy. So you've probably seen the Wheel of Life in the vestibule, in the lobby of the shrine room. And you've got this, the second most circle contains a light half and a dark half. Yeah? Bit like the Light King and the Dark King, and the light is that moving up, is the growth and development, but the dark is the kind of the falling down, the contraction. Because life is flow, life is fluid, life is always moving, life is king. We're either moving forward or we're moving backwards. And we can change, yeah? But we can also direct that change. We are directing that change, whether we realise it or not. So, a man accessing the king not only knows change, but he takes responsibility for directing that change. He can change himself, the second point. Man can change, but he can change himself. A king sits on the throne of karmic responsibility. He is lord of his mandala. So, because everything changes, this applies to us, but because we're sentient beings, we're aware that we're aware, we make choices. We're not victims of fate, we are not subject to a creator God's will. Yes, we're kind of dealt various hands in life, but we choose how we play them. And quite often we're the dealer, dealing us the cards as well, but... And we're making these choices, we're directing change every single second of our lives. And in so doing, this is how we shape our realm, this is how we shape our mandala. So how do we direct change? So to take another angle on this, I'm really kind of firing dharmic content at you this morning. To take another angle on this, another angle on impermanence and the insubstantiality that underlies the truth of change and the fact that we can direct change, is to talk about it in terms of conditionality. Everything arises in dependence upon conditions. This retreat arose in dependence upon conditions. The fact that there's a retreat centre here, physically here, all these facilities, the fact there's a community to run it, and the fact that there's people who want to come on retreat, put those things together, and you get a retreat. Any one of those things missing, and you don't have a retreat. And each of those conditions, well, conditions gave rise to that. And if you see this, if you see that, oh, actually, I want D. I'd really like D in my life. So I need to put in place A, B, and C. Yeah, so it's not just I just need to really kind of think positive D thoughts and then the universe will provide D. It's just like, no, it doesn't work like that. I know there are videos on YouTube that tell you it does work like that, but it doesn't work like that. You need to put in place certain things. And there are lots of different levels upon which, conditionality operates. And I'm going to be talking about the karmic level. Everything is not karma. That's another wrong view. There's various different ways in which things occur. You know, just if a meteorite hit the shrine room right now, there's just like there are laws of science that explain that. Karma's got nothing to do with it. But there are karmic processes. Karma is something that operates in the universe. And karma literally means action. Yeah? It's very misused in our culture, the word karma. It literally means action. But every choice we make is an action. Yeah? Every time we make a choice, that's an action, and every action has a consequence. So, what about the karmic level of conditionality? So, I'm going to hand over to the Buddha now, in the Dhammapada. Experiences are preceded by mind, led by mind, and produced by mind. If one speaks or acts with an impure mind, suffering follows, even as the cart wheel follows the hoof of the ox, drawing the cart. Experiences are preceded by mind, led by mind, and produced by mind. If one speaks or acts with a pure mind, happiness follows like a shadow that never departs. So in these two verses, in the first one, if you act, speak, or act with an impure mind, with a mind coloured tainted by greed, hatred, and delusion? Well, it's actually, it produces suffering. It just makes life really crap for you and for those around you, actually. But if you speak or act with a pure mind, a mind coloured, flavoured by love, by generosity, by wisdom, well, then happiness is something that will colour your existence. That is what will happen. And because our thoughts, words and actions shape the world we live in. They shape the way we see the world and the way we relate to it. If you operate in terms of anger, then the world can just seem very threatening. If you operate out of greed, then you can have the world is a world of scarcity and lack. I remember once a friend of mine got kicked out of home and housed in this hostel where a lot of drug addicts used to be, and the world they lived in this world of mistrust and acquisition, and it was they just shaped it for themselves, and they dwelt in it. It was just like, yeah, it was quite a wake up call to, you know, what can happen if you go down a particular path. So our minds shape our words, our thoughts and our deeds. Our thoughts, words and our deeds shape our minds. And all of this forms the lens through which we view our world, how we interpret it. And the next lines from the Dhammapada draw out the practical implications of this. Those who entertain such thoughts as, he abused me, he beat me, he conquered me, he robbed me, will not still their hatred. Those who do not entertain such thoughts as, he abused me, he beat me, he conquered me, he robbed me, will still their hatred. Not by hatreds are hatreds ever pacified here in the world. They are pacified by love. This is the eternal law. If you indulge in resentment, there's no end to it. I think the expression pet hate is a very good one. I imagine this is a little hate creature. You stroke and you feed, and it just gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And that's just how it works. What you give attention to grows. If it's resentment, your world will be a world of resentment. If it's love, your world will be a world of love. The choice really is that simple. It really is. We're moving forward or we're moving backwards. We're on the light path of expansion, growth and development, or on the dark path of moving backwards and contracting. The choice is ours. We are sovereign lords of our own lands, of our own mandalas. This is the law of karma. This is how the universe is configured. This is how it works. Just as the universe has magnetism and gravity, so it has karma. Yeah, and this is your faith in the law of karma. It's just like, do you think if I do that, I could get away with it? I could get away with it. It's not like I chuck a rock above my head and think gravity. Yeah, I could probably get away with it, couldn't I? This time, I reckon it's not going to fall this time. It's just like, yeah, it just doesn't work. Like, I mean, you can think that, but it's not great, is it? Yeah, so we can change. We can change. We can shape our kingdom. We can transform our mandala. And this shaping is described in another passage. Irrigators draw off water. Fletchers straighten arrows. Carpenters shape wood. The spiritually mature discipline themselves. I've always really loved these images. Images very familiar from the time of the Buddha. You know, you just see it in the fields, in the villages. These things going on the whole time. And because, yeah, just as the farmer, he digs these channels to direct waters from the river to his crops. You know, he has to make a choice. His crops are there, the river's there, so he digs a channel. But actually, when we're being unskillful, this is like crops are there, river's there, when we're just like, we're digging channels over there into the swamplands to make them more swampy. But actually, the waters need to come this way. And with the with the Fletcher straightening the arrows. When I was a kid, I used to get a stick, put a bit of string on it, and get some twigs, and they'd just like be all over the place. But the skill that's involved in shaping and perfecting the art of making an arrow so it just flies straight, it hits its target. That's what we want. We want to kind of shape a mind that hits its target. And of course, at first, when we're kids, just like making these kind of like, just making it up with what we've got, and it's flying all over the place. But actually, there's a training that can show us how to do it, how to shape arrows that do hit their mark. And and this image of the carpenter, I mean, it's just like you've got to have real imagination to see this kind of lump of unpromising wood and what it could become. What it could become in a way is already contained in that wood, but it takes imagination to really kind of, and vision to really see what it could become, and then effort, skill to shape it, to plane it, to chisel it, to saw it, to sand it, and to create something. All of these images, they do convey effort. Your change requires effort. It's not easy. It's not going to happen on its own. It's certainly, as Buddha Siya said when he was introducing me, it took a lot of effort to change, a lot of effort. And it also required never giving up. The most important thing is never give up. Just keep going. Just keep going. Because, it's just so easy to just slip back to our old ways of being. Man can change. He can change himself. He can help others to change. A king wears the crown of benevolence. He blesses others by supporting them and helping them to realize their potential. So it's very natural to go to a Buddhist center because you want to change. I went to a Buddhist center because I wanted to change. Yeah, I needed to change. Expression that used to come to mind was going for refuge at gunpoint. It's just, as soon as I stopped making effort, there was just like my old self. Just, staring back at me, pointing the gun, like, okay, yep, meditation, it's great, yep. Yep, yep. Yep. Buddhism is not just about us, is it? There's the truth of impermanence, the truth of insubstantiality. The truth of insubstantiality points to the fact that it's not just this dry, kind of like crazy conceptual idea. It's our lives are intimately connected. Our lives are interwoven. We're not these separate, discrete little kind of bots, kind of operating in our own little kind of boxes. We're all affecting each other all the time. I mean, you could probably get a sense of that just even in the silence. You pick up on people, and we do affect each other. The mandala of our lives is not a dead, inert concept. It's a mandala of living beings. Our lives are filled with people. I mean, when you do the Metta Bhavana, when I did the Metta Bhavana, one of the things I realized was it was as though the world was just this two-dimensional kind of like film that kind of just like went past my vision. It wasn't alive somehow, but it is. So we have this, our lives are full of people, and we can help other people to change, but we can't change people. Yeah. Banti tells this, has got a joke he tells in a talk about this Boy Scout leader asked him what his good deed for the day was, and he said, "Oh, I helped an old woman to cross the road." And the scout leader's just like, "Well, that's not that great, is it?" And he's like, "She didn't want to cross the road." So that's not what we're trying to do. Yeah, it has to be intelligent. It has to be intelligent. Those who want to change, okay, well, let's help them to change. Those that don't, it's fine. It's fine. But at least we can avoid blocking people's growth. The Buddha was an exceptional individual. Yeah, he did achieve supreme perfect liberation on his own. That's what he did. But few, if any of us, could achieve even a fraction of what he did without the help of others. We need people. When I first went along to the Buddhist Center, it was because I couldn't do it on my own. I needed other people. I needed other people that shared those values. We need Sangha. We need the flow of Kalyanamitrita, the flow of spiritual friendship. It's as though the Buddha, when he attained enlightenment, this great blazing inferno of wisdom was lit. And his disciples from that lit torches, and they lit torches of their disciples, and so on, and so on, and so on. Down to us in this shrine room, actually, you know, the extent to which we're practicing the Dharma, we're holding this flaming torch. And you'll come across this quote on the Adhisthana website. "Tradition is the handing on of the flame and not the worship of ashes." This chain of torches, one lighting another, lighting another, lighting another, came down to Sangharakshita. He lit the torches of his disciples. I am a disciple of a disciple of a disciple of Sangharakshita. Each man lit a torch which was handed to me. A torch has been handed to you. And Banti himself, he didn't have to do this. In a way, his temperament, what would have suited him was just to stay in India, just carry on, just practicing the Dharma, studying, writing, being quite, you know, perhaps doing a few lecture tours on the plains. But his life would have been so much easier if he'd have done that. But he found that the Buddhism that there was in the West in the 1960s was lacking. it was lacking, shall we say. And so it's like, right, he's going to give up his idyllic existence in a small hermitage in the foothills of the Himalayas in Kalimpong, come to the UK and, yeah, just start befriending people, start communicating the Dharma, start teaching meditation in a small basement room in a shop in London. And in this way, yeah, he passed on the flame. He's passed on the flame to us, this flame that's burnt for over 2,500 years. And when you were taught the Dharma, you were entrusted with this sacred flame. And it is up to you to tend it, to feed it, to fan it, to protect it from the wind and water of inner and outer harmful influences, but also to help others to tend their flames. Yeah, when their flames start to splutter and fade, to, you know, just offer the hand of friendship. Yeah, when you're, and this does happen, it's not just like this kind of like crazy trajectory of living the dream. When your flame, you know, starts to flicker, is to actually reach out to your brothers in the Dharma and just, you know, just, I mean, I've done this. I remember at a certain point, just Buddhasiya had a particularly cataclysmic end to a relationship, so we say. And, you know, I just remember saying to Buddhasiya in the shop, I need a friend. I need a friend. Just everything was kind of like, yeah, falling apart. And he was a friend, and various friends during that time, they just came around me like this band of brothers, just, yeah, as though there was this shield wall around me, just holding me while I fell apart, but in such a way as I could become more. And when you're ordained, you have an explicit responsibility to do this, to hand on this flame. But you don't have to be an order member to do this. 99%, probably more than 99%, of being an order member is just being a friend. It's just friendship. Yeah, you know, you can see people giving talks, teaching meditation, blah, 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 all the rest of it. But actually, just like the vast majority of it is just reaching out to people, just being a friend. Because this flame isn't transmitted through some kind of abstract osmosis. It's through friendship. It's through human connection. It can seem quite magical, but this is how it works. And it's just, I couldn't have done it without other people. My name, Sanghanista, means he who is intent on, depending on, grounded on, and devoted to the spiritual community. Just like I need spiritual community. I can't operate without spiritual community in the way that I do. If the spiritual community all decided they just wanted to watch Netflix and drink beer, and I was left on my own being the only one who still wanted to do it, I'd have to just recreate Sangha. I'd have to recreate Sangha to continue to operate. But it was because people took me on, because people reached out to me, that I could change and grow and develop. And what this boils down to, in a way, this whole point, what it boils down to is relating to people on the basis of their potential, not on who they are. If we see change, and we see that people can change, then we have a responsibility to relate to people on the basis of their potential, not let them off the hook when they behave like a numpty, but and not let ourselves off the hook when we behave like a numpty. Yes, we do need to relate to ourselves on the basis of our potential. And if we do this, how to put this? Yeah, a man who is accessing the king, this is how he relates to others. He knows his abundance, and he shares it. And because he shares his abundance grows. Yeah, it's very counterintuitive, but actually, the more you give, the more you have. The more you kind of hoard, the kind of, yeah, everything tarnishes and crumbles and turns to ash. So, man can change. He can change himself. He can help others to change. Together, they can change the world. The king wields the scepter of compassionate activity, and he joins forces with and cooperates with other kings. It's almost as though a sangha is this a federation of kingdoms, you could say. And the more we grow and develop, the more we help others to grow and develop, the more we cooperate with others who are engaged in this process, then the less we are swayed by the world. Yeah, if you're just on your own, if you're just like that solitary tree in the middle of the prairie, you know, just like the winds come and they blow you down. But if you're in a forest, then you're held, you're sheltered by everything else around you. But more than that, it's not just you're less affected by the world, you can influence the world. You can have a much greater impact on the world. There's a real myth of the solitary hero in our culture. I think every single film that Steven Seagal has ever made, the Die Hard films, the whole pseudo Christian myth of the chosen one. It's about the solitary hero, the kind of the savior. But actually is about coming together with others. It's about coming together with others. We are so much greater when we come together with others. And it's also important to know that the Dharma is not a psychological adjustment technique. Yeah? So a lot of people make a lot of money from presenting the Dharma as a psychological adjustment technique, or from extracting kind of various different techniques from it and then presenting them as such. But there's a lot of good in the world, and the world is deeply dysfunctional. Yeah, the world we live in is quite dysfunctional. And you just need to look at the news and you know that the world is quite deeply dysfunctional. And if we are just trying to function better in the world, if we're just trying to function better in a dysfunctional world, it's only by becoming dysfunctional ourselves that we can do that. Yeah? Actually, what the Dharma is saying is you need to swim against the stream. You need to swim against the currents of the world. You need to challenge the currents of the world. You need to challenge the views of the world. Now, when I was younger, and I was looking, you know, I had this quest for meaning, you know, this kind of thing tugging at my sleeve, saying there's more. I'd go to the library and I'd get various books out. This is before the internet, by the way. And one of the books I got out was a book on philosophy, and in that book there was a section on political philosophy. I was talking to Matt about this the other day. And in there, there was a section on anarchism, which I thought was amazing. I'd never come across anything like it. Just this kind of this vision of a social utopia. But I followed it up, read various different books, but it's just like, this is all very well, but I couldn't quite fully articulate that but. But having come across the Dharma, the but is greed, hatred, and delusion. Yeah? We have, all of us have, I have greed, hatred, and delusion. You know, it's they're operating in me. Those three animals you see at the wheel of life, turning the wheel. And if you're not addressing those, well, they will just kind of, you know, institutionalize themselves into the structures of the world we live in, of the kind of society we create. You can see, I'm sure I don't need to give you examples, but a lot of the world is institutionalized greed, hatred, and delusion. And yeah, you're kind of told that you're a bit of a weirdo if you don't buy into it. So what the I've never lost that idealism of my youth. It's just become a bit more intelligent, and I've seen the need to transform myself, and I've seen the need to help other people to transform before as a basis for having a positive impact on the world. And Buddhism talks about has this whole myth of pure lands. So a pure land, a Buddha field, a Buddha land is an enlightened being, a Buddha or a highly advanced Bodhisattva. They create a Buddha field. A Buddha field is a field of living beings, it famously says in one of the texts. And we all have a sphere of influence around us. But the more developed we are, then the more that becomes a spiritual sphere of influence, and the bigger that becomes. And when we come together with others, well, it just grows exponentially. And one of the images that, one of the myths Banti talks about, Sangharakshita talks about for the order, is as thousand-armed Avalokiteshvara. So, Avalokiteshvara, in the story, he's a yogi, and he's practicing the Dharma, and he makes a vow that he will liberate all beings from suffering, from samsara. That He will, and if he wavers from this task, you know, may my head and body split into a multitude of pieces, different pieces, may I shatter. And so he practices, and he, you know, here he is, the solitary hero, practicing, communicating the Dharma, teaching people the mantra Om Mani Padme Hum. And then he steps back and he surveys the world, and it seems that nothing has changed. All this hard work, and you know, he really went for it, but all this hard work, it seems like nothing has changed. On his own, trying to do it on his own, nothing has changed. So he gets despondent, and for a fraction of a second he just thinks, God, maybe I should give up. You know, can I really do this? Is it even possible? And so, because he's made this vow, and the basis upon which he's made this vow, his body and his head splits into all these different pieces. And he cries out in agony to his guru, the Red Buddha, Amitabha, for aid, for assistance. And Amitabha responds. And Amitabha responds by reforming him. Not as he was, but in this new form, which has 1,000 arms, each reaching out into the world, and with 11 heads, even placing his own head, Amitabha's own head, on the top. And this new form, well, it has 11 heads, so it can see in all the different directions of space. It can see the suffering of all beings everywhere. But it has these 1,000 arms, so it can reach out, it can respond. And what Bhante says about the order is that it's each order member is a hand of Avalokiteshvara. And I would say the extent to which an order member is effective is the extent to which they are a hand of Avalokiteshvara reaching out into the world. And when people ask to join the order, what they're effectively asking for is to become one of the hands of Avalokiteshvara, not to become the solitary hero, but to become one of the hands of Avalokiteshvara, to join that vast mandala just reaching out and expanding into the world. Because a king works with others, he cooperates with others, he doesn't need to be special, he doesn't need to be seen as special. Bhante once said about the status of an order member is a no status. If you want status through practicing the spiritual life, then you'll be much better off in the world, to be honest. Because you're not seeking to just be the special one. You're seeking to work with others, to create community, to support others to grow and develop, and for that influence to ripple out into the world. And for those ripples to become bigger and bigger and to go further and further. So, to conclude, to sum up, we have this first proposition: man can change. A good king is a wise king. He sees the truth of change. He can change himself. On the basis of knowing change, he sits on the throne of karmic responsibility. He creates order in his life through spiritual discipline, through a system of practice, through seeing karmic, the workings of karma, and aligning himself with it, rather than kind of like figuring out different ways he can kind of dodge it. He can help others to change, and indeed he does. He wears the crown of benevolence. He helps others to create order in their lives. He blesses them. He helps them to grow and develop. Yet a king doesn't try and keep the throne for himself. That's a tyrant. Yet a king helps others to become kings. Together, the important word in this one being together, together they can change the world. He wields the scepter of compassionate activity. He comes together with other kings to transform the world, to create the best possible conditions for all beings to encounter reality. Pranikata was talking about the other day, so that they can activate the highest potential. Because this isn't just about us. It's easy for the Dharma to be subverted by the ego project and just become so much spiritual cosmetic surgery. Here, between us, it's as though, Bhante's spoken about this in the past, it's as though we're sitting on a vast store of grain, yeah? And we live in a world that's starving, a world that is starved of meaning and purpose, a world that lacks kings, that lacks kingliness. In all of this, it's important to bring it down to earth. And what I'm going to ask you, and perhaps suggest that you talk about in the groups, is what are the next steps for you? Practically, what are the next steps? I would imagine you've already been thinking about this, having done the mandala exercise. And so you've looked at what your life, what your mandala looks like. You've looked at what you'd like it to look like in 3 years' time. Well, what are the stepping stones? Think in terms of a precept. One precept. It's very tempting to go away from a retreat. It's like, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that, I'm going to meditate every day, do two pujas a day, I'm going to like read a book on the Dharma like three times a day, and all the rest of it. And that's great. You know, that enthusiasm, that inspiration, that is great. But it's, and you know, it's almost like, yeah, the blue sky thinking out of which you kind of go, and I can realistically do that one, and I'm going to commit to doing that one. And that's what I'm taking back from this retreat with me. So do think about that. A quick shot across the bows. A word of warning from the Buddha, from the man, about what happens if you don't do these things. Those who have not led the spiritual life or obtained the wealth of merit in their youth, such as these brood over the past like aged herons in a pond without fish. Those who have not led the spiritual life or obtained the wealth of merit in their youth, such as these lie like worn out arrows lamenting the things of old. Ooh. So, a shot across the bows, but a call to action as well. Until one is committed, there is hesitancy, the chance to draw back, always ineffectiveness. Concerning all acts of initiative and creation, there is one elementary truth, the ignorance of which kills countless ideas and splendid plans. That the moment one definitely commits oneself, then providence moves too. All sorts of things occur to help one that would never have otherwise occurred. A whole stream of events issues from the decision, raising in one's favour all manner of unforeseen incidents and meetings and material assistance, which no man could have dreamed would come his way. Whatever you can do, or dream you can, begin it. Boldness has genius, power, and magic.